Hello, everybody, and welcome to the China Tech Investor Podcast, powered by Technode, seeking truth from facts when it comes to Chinese tech stocks and IPOs. I'm Elliot Zagman, and with me is a man who is not simply one James, but many James in one. It's James Hall.
All right. I'm not sure if...
You ever thought about that? Like, your name, there you have people who are Jim.
That's my son's name, by the way.
Then what becomes a James?
So it should be Jim's?
But you have where is the James? There are multiple James. What's up with the S at the end?
I don't know.
Charles, the same thing, right?
That is a deep question that I think we need to find. I don't know. James is in the Bible, so we gotta go way back to find the answer to. Okay,
James is a book of the Bible, and also a disciple. Yeah. Right? There are two characters who are James. Like there's two or three Johns, right? Something. Anyways, okay. Where
John wrote three books. James
wrote one book.
Three, two.
But James is also a disciple. So that I went to Sunday school, right? So there was oh man, I'm trying to remember the songs. They taught me about to remember everything. Never mind. Anyways, let's do the disclaimer.
All right, disclaimer. Nothing said on this podcast is investment advice, even if it sounds like advice. It's not. While we try not to, and we and our guests may get our numbers wrong, so, you know, we're going to be talking about Ant Group, and we're going to be mentioning numbers, and they might be wrong, so go check it out yourself. Also, this podcast is recorded in the past. Specifically, today is Sunday, September 20th in the morning for me. Evening for you in Bangkok, and you know, in a couple days these views may not be relevant anymore, so do your own research,
which is why we're not going to talk about ByteDance TikTok and
Oracle. That's constantly changing. It's too fluid.
It changes every 2 hours. Anyways, technodes.com/newsletters for your daily dose of China tech. We're not doing a guest today. We're not going to do a big long rundown, because when it comes to Chinese tech stocks and IPOs, we have what may be the biggest China tech stock and IPO of all time, which is Ant Financial, the company who is, I guess, affiliated with Alibaba, but not Alibaba. That is the financial services lubricant of the Alibaba ecosystem, I guess we could call it. Some might call it the biggest bank in the world. But it's IPOing, and there's a lot of excitement around it. We've talked about them before, but today that's what we're devoted to. James and I going into Ant Financial. So
yeah,
where to start? So James, you look...
Well, hold on. Okay. So I think Ant Group, if there was someone here, they would say, wait, we're not a bank. We're not a bank. We own a 30% stake of my bank, which is also is a JV with a bunch of other parties, one of which is Fosun's Guo Guangcheng, I think is his name. But they're not technically a bank. They don't take risk. They don't underwrite. They don't do any of that. They're just kind of like a tech provider. So they used to call themselves TechFin, but they're kind of like the FinTech or TechFin super app of China.
So
is what I would kind of
this company, call them. Depending on who you ask, it does seem like This IPO, which is going to be a dual listing, both in Hong Kong and in that new star market that we've talked about in Shanghai, in the mainland, it looks like it's going to be somewhere between $200 and $300 billion that they're valued at, which would be the biggest IPO of all time, or at least the biggest highest valued company to IPO of all time. What's weird...
They're also raising the most money. I mean, if they raise $30 billion, that's the most money.
But what's weird to me is that we're in a situation where it's a company that could be the biggest IPO of all time, that could raise more money than any other company to go public of all time. And when we ask even experts, what are they? There is a silence and a, well... So what are they? Like what the way that I say, you know, like I said, it's the biggest bank or the biggest, it's banking, China's banking system or Chinese banking digitized. How would we explain it?
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, let's look at their history, right? So they started in October 2004, and it was kind of, I mean, people might think this is wrong, but they kind of copied PayPal. So PayPal was bought by eBay in 2002. PayPal, actually, eBay bought a different online payment company, and that one lost. I don't even remember the name of it. And they bought PayPal. PayPal then spun off in 2015, I think.
So essentially, what they were is you had an e-commerce platform, which was eBay or Alibaba or Taobao or whatever, and PayPal was the financial services kind of provider, the connector.
It was basically like the escrow between the buyers and the sellers. So okay. That's how Alipay started off. It was basically like send money to Alipay. When your package arrives, open it, look at it, make sure it's not like a piece of junk and falling apart or not the thing you ordered, and then go into the escrow account and click release. And you didn't have to do that. Like I always did it, but some of my friends would just let it go. And after a couple of weeks, it would eventually release to the seller. So that's how it started. Then they kind of...
It was a trust enablement mechanism, yeah, essentially.
Yeah. So in their listing doc, they talk about the trust deficit that they seeked to, you know, fix, which I think PayPal, eBay, kind of same thing was going on there. So, but obviously, like you say with the giraffe and the
Okapi,
they grew up into different things in different environments. Right. And now you have, I was just listening.
Divergent evolution, right? So two animals who have a similar ancestor, they go and, yeah, depending on their environments, they grow into completely different animals.
Similar reason to be, and they became very different things. And now you have, you know, the PayPal, I think, CEO and president was at a conference, and he's, you know, someone asked him about Alipay and what he thinks about them. And he's like, yeah, we learn a lot from them. They learned a lot from us. We're learning a lot from them. And actually, he's actually talked to the CEO of Alipay, or the old CEO of Alipay back in the day. So there's a lot of learning going on. And that's the thing about financial services, is there's a lot of copying in financial services. If you have a good idea, yeah, it just gets copied, because it's just very abstract kind of stuff. So anyway, I can keep going through the history of Alipay.
What I want to know is what, I know some of this story, we can talk about it a little bit, but how did they differentiate themselves? I mean, there were credit cards in China to some extent. Everyone had a bank card in China. You know, when I first got there, it was either cash or bank card by which everyone was paying. And so that doesn't seem that different from, for example, like how in the States, there's, you know, you kind of just attach your credit card to everything and just make it work. But there was that divergence. So what happened with Alipay that allowed it? What was not there in China that Alipay was able to provide? And let's talk about that divergence. When did it go from being the Canthro matrix or the common ancestor, right, and actually become the giraffe to PayPal?
So credit cards weren't really a big thing, but people did have banks. But you did have to used to have to carry cash everywhere. And I think the real big change was when, I mean, there was a bunch of big kind of stepwise phase shifts, we could call them. And I think the first one was probably, the really big one was probably Yuebao.
What's Yuebao in English?
Leftover treasure or something like that.
Right. It's a savings account.
Yeah.
Or a high interest savings account.
It's basically a savings account. So it started off, they had like really high yields on it, and then it quickly went down as they raised tons and tons of money. And the funny thing about it is once they had all this capital, they then went to the banks and said, okay, hey banks, we have all this capital, we want to deposit it in your bank, but we want to negotiate a very good return interest income. And so they were able to get, you know, much higher than everybody could have gotten. The lowest amount you could put into Yuebao was like 1 RMB. And you could take it out immediately, and you would get like an annualized sort of yield, and it would go down over time. It wasn't like a fixed yield. It would, you know, move, but it just basically just went down. And they raised a ton of money. I think they had, by February 2014, they had 81 million users, and it quickly became, I forget how fast, but it was like maybe a year or so, and it became like the biggest mutual fund in China. Like, it might have been even a month or something. It was really fast.
So essentially, this was money that either people would have already put in their bank accounts or just not put anywhere at all.
Right.
And would have kept in cash.
Because the interest, if you put money in your bank account, your interest you got was like 0.35% a year or something like that. It was just pitiful. So everyone's like, oh, this sucks. And I mean, some people did do that and they just, your inflation's killing you every year, basically. So UL Bell came around. I think I remember the very beginning, it was like 9%. And then like a couple hours later, it was like 8%. And then the next day it was like 7%. And then the next, it like dropped pretty quickly.
I've talked with Martin Chorzempa. He has written a lot for Caixin. He was with the Peterson Institute. He writes for The Wire China. He has been researching this for quite some time. And one thing that I've had some talks with him kind of in his brainstorming this whole book. And one of the things that he's discussed is, this idea of whether or not Ant Financial and this whole kind of rise of the fintech giant in China is something that was kind of top down, or was it something that was a disruption of the state finance apparatus, right? The state banking apparatus.
I would 100% say it's the latter.
Yeah, that was his conclusion as well. Yeah. The term that I use is that it was something that I think at the point of there in which they rose, like it was something that was kind of tacitly approved, right? That they wanted innovation in some of the digital spheres, and that the focus of the highest levels in Beijing were on other things at the time. And then when the focus shifted back around, it was like, oh, look what we have. And then it was like, how do we institutionalize this? How do we integrate it within the state banking system, which I think is something that's still going on. But anyways.
Oh yeah. Ever since UL Bell, it launched in 2013, but ever since then banks have been mad about this because they lost like a large part of their deposits, and that hurts them. That's part of their funding, source. So these cheap deposits were very, very helpful. Now this wasn't the only reason they kind of lost them. There were other reasons, but anyway, then I think the next big phase shift was probably, and I don't know when exactly this was, but kind of the whole online to offline QR code thing, allowing basically signing up merchants, getting them to use Alipay. I think they got Walmart. They got another French kind of grocery company. I forget the name right now.
Carrefour? Carrefour was the big one. Yeah.
They got Carrefour. And so, people, I don't know if people were really using that. I mean, I got on Alipay like 2010, and it was like really annoying for a foreigner to get on there, because you don't have a Shenzhen.
Yeah, the ID card. I think in 2013, 2014 was the time that I remember, my friends who were in, like my Chinese friends who were within like the closer with the whole like, like how you have certain, like there's a buzzword and then they all kind of like get behind that buzzword. And it was like 2013, 2014 where O2O was the thing and everyone was doing O2O. It was when you had those kind of Uber DD wars, but at the same time, it was when they were taking these digital payments platforms. Either WeChat went from a chat platform to payments, and Alipay here and Ant Financial went from essentially an e-commerce processing platform to the real world.
Yeah, I mean it's it's super interesting.
So what's the next stage? So they and WeChat had the QR codes that they basically were putting in, every single, whether it be.
Yeah. And then there was this like major competition to sign up merchants, and they slowly did it. And then there's also competition to invest in startups and like get them on their payment platform. And then there's competitions, with like JD and getting JD on WeChat, and anyway, like there's just a ton of competition, and that could be part of the reason why we don't see take rates rising for these companies, but we can talk about that when we go into kind of their different business segments.
So they're a payments processor. They're the equivalent of a, in some ways, the equivalent of a credit card company in the States, kind of like they're kind of like a Visa, right? In you have Visa, MasterCard, you have Ant and WeChat. Maybe that's not exactly the right comparison.
I don't think so. I mean, it's a little bit more like it's really more like PayPal a little bit. And that you have like your capital in there and you can kind of move it in and out. And I think PayPal is trying to become more like them. And obviously there's Stripe and all these. There's a like the payment processing ecosystem is very diverse in the West, whereas in China, it's kind of a little bit less so. And you have these big guys.
Either the state.
Yeah. You have the banks, which by the way, I mean, Alipay pays the banks. WeChat Pay pays the banks. They pay them for transaction fees, and they're high. I mean, like, you know, I just making the assumption that their digital payments revenue is the only thing that's related to their transaction fees, which maybe it's not, but it used to be 50% transaction fees were 50% of digital payments.
Jeez Louise.
And now it's 87%. So it's even more. It's just gone. It's gone up. And that might be because transaction fees in the past used to be kind of have like maybe peer-to-peer lending in there, which they got rid of, you know, in their whole listing document. They didn't once mention their peer-to-peer lending platform that they used to have, Jiao Tai Bao, I think it was called. But that's old.
So at this point, what is their business?
So there's basically two pieces. There's digital payments and merchant services. I'm just going to call it digital payments. And the other piece is called digital finance technology platform. So I'm just going to call that their fintech platform. Okay. And then they have like innovation initiatives, which the only thing they mention in there is Ant Chain, which started to generate revenues last year in 2019. So, okay. So digital payments, it's basically, you know, it's a payment business. The majority of their service revenues come from transaction fees that they generate from merchants and transaction platforms. And they kind of just, they said, we have begun to generate revenues from merchant services. So that's why I don't want to call this digital payments and merchant services. I just call it digital payments. But that piece is expected to grow a lot.
So merchant services would be something like some sort of POS system or some sort of...
Kind of like what Meituan probably does.
Okay.
Yeah, there's... You know, I think the what's going on here is Ali and WeChat probably see that their transaction fee business is potentially at risk with DCEP, and so they need to grow their ecosystem through merchant services rather than through transaction fees.
And for our listeners, by the way, DCEP, in case they don't listen to every single episode, is the state digital currency, the digital yuan, the digital RMB in China that they've been rolling out.
Digital, it stands for, it's DCEP, digital currency electronic payment. So
half their business is transactions, which are, you know, you mentioned earlier, are shrinking as far as the stake, the cut that they're getting out of it, and then may continue to shrink as there is competition in there from DCEP. So that doesn't seem too great from my perspective, right? But what's the rest of it?
Okay, so that is, I mean, let's just, the percentage of revenues for digital payments in 2017 was 54%. Then it's kind of slowly declined as they've added to the fintech platform revenues, okay? So that's gone from 55 to 52 to 43, and then in this first half of this year to 36. Okay, so it's very nice steady decline in terms of percentage of total revenues. And that's because they've been increasing their fintech platform. So here we have three fintechs. We have a credit tech, investment tech, and insure tech. And they basically do what they sound like, right? Credit tech is basically consumer credit and small, medium business credit. And, you know, when you read their listing doc, they after each one of these, they're the largest in that in some terms. So they're, for credit tech, they're the largest in terms of outstanding credit balance originated through their platform. Now that balance doesn't stay on their balance sheet, so that's why they're not a bank. it kind of just flows through their platform.
What does it mean by, what do you mean by flows through? How does that?
So because Alipay is kind of like, they have lots of users, hundreds of millions of users. I think it's 711 or something. They have so many users, they're able to basically demand aggregation for financial services. So they're able to kind of put stuff, show them things. You know, they have a super app that you can go through and click through. There's all sorts of services in there, one of which is getting consumer loans or small business loans. So
they're not holding a balance themselves. So Yuebao.
No. So they'll connect. No, Yuebao is a totally separate thing. So they'll connect those consumers or small businesses to lenders on their platform. And they're actually not, by law, they're not allowed to make any investments with their own balance sheet. They do that through My Bank, which is that JV that I mentioned in the beginning. So that's really important.
So they're essentially an interface between layer between the banks and the consumer or the businesses.
Right. And so it's a two-sided platform, right? Okay. You have the consumers or the businesses on one side, and then you have the lenders that want to find good credit worthy, you know, people to lend to and businesses to lend to. And because Alipay has the data on these people, if they're small, medium business, maybe they use their platform for all their revenues, or they get at least, you know, some percentage, 50% maybe through Alipay and the other 50 from WeChat. I mean, then some more from cash or whatever. So maybe not 50, but so they know at least something more than the banks know about these businesses. So they're able to kind of share some data about, hey, look, their revenues really are, I mean, verified from coming through our platform are X. Mm. So we believe if you lend to them at this, you know, amount and this rate and whatever, that'll be good. But here's the gotcha, you know, and maybe we, you know, actually I'll save that for later. Well, we're going to do a kind of. But
they're Uber for finance in China. Like, I think that might be the way to put it, in that they are the, if you're a bank and you want to reach the, so Uber doesn't provide the actual taxi ride, but they are they provide either the efficiency and the pricing mechanism, the payment mechanism between the user and the driver in that case.
And so that's the same for all these fintech segments. I mean, so credit tech, bingo. The investment tech, same thing. Investment tech, this is your Yuebao money market funds, your mutual funds. This is where your My Bank kind of thing sits. They have Tianhong, which is the group that runs Yuebao's kind of money market funds. But they have other mutual funds on there, and those other mutual funds that sell their products. So they're basically offering distribution to these financial services, these asset managers, and distribution of their financial products, right? So then they collect a distribution fee for that. And it's not huge. Basically, here they charge technology service fees primarily as a percentage of AUM, okay? So it's not small either, but it's, you know, compared to the biggest of these three is credit tech, and then investment tech is next, and then insure tech is the smallest, but potentially the largest potential grower, you know, depending on how you think China will, how much insurance you think Chinese people will buy in the future. And yeah, so then insure tech, just insurance needs. And here they charge a technology service fee. Every one of these is a technology service fee, by the way, fees. So I'm sure they have other names and things in there, but that's a percentage of insurance premiums. So the amounts that you're paying, I guess, for that insurance, you know, on a monthly or yearly basis, however it's done.
So essentially if I'm an insurer and I want to know who, car insurance, let's just put it that.
Sure.
And I want to know who is, so a big issue, I mean, you know, we both got our licenses when we were teenagers in the United States, right? And we had the problem of being teenage boys, you know, with having to pay teenage boy insurance, right? You know, so because the data that they were drawing off was, okay, well, their age and their gender and their, you know, the all of those things, and you know, the likelihood that they will, you know, get into a crash or be responsible for an accident, right? But in this case, what they, by having this sort of platform where, you know, Ant Financial is connected to all this financial data for so many folks in China, if you're an insurer, you can get potentially a more accurate insurance quote, or say, okay, well, these people you can give a better rate to, or these are the customers that you want to go after. So if you are an insurer, there's almost no...
I mean, you kind of, you take an aquarial sort of view of like a whole population, and it's pretty broad. I don't know if they need to go so granular like they would on like a credit risk assessment. But what they're really paying for here, again, is distribution. Mm. So, you know, if you're Geico, Progressive, you're paying for online advertising to try to find new customers. Once you find a customer, it's very rare that they change in insurance. So, you know, that's a very high priced, you know, AdWord or advertising area. So, I mean, I'm surprised they don't make more money.
But it's ad plus financial data, though. That's the intersection, though. It's like Google AdWords kind of mixed with, they would be able to have more data to determine if you're selling a financial product, you know, to be able to price that financial product. Is that am I going up the right tree there? Am I correct?
Yeah, I mean, with auto, like for example, auto insurance, you know probably more interesting would be how the person drives, and you can figure that out with like telematics and stuff like that. But maybe, I mean, you know, maybe that's something Baidu could do, because if you're using Baidu's map to drive around, or whatever Galdu, you know, whatever app map you're using, you probably know how much people are speeding and you know, right, stopping quickly, because you can check the accelerometer in a phone. But anyway.
But you could also figure, let's say it's health insurance, right? You could see how many cigarettes somebody is buying. You know, it's the So the,
well, I don't know if they get data. I mean, if they go and buy stuff at the, like, you know, Mingyan, like store, right, like the famous alcohol, famous cigarettes sort of, or like,
but those are less and less than 7-Elevens are more and more.
Right. Know? Right. But if you go, so
it's a growth.
I think the store name will tell you what kind of things they're buying, but I don't think they'll see into the receipt. Like, I don't know. I don't think their data goes. I think they just see how much they paid and where it was. Mm. I don't think they get like a full inventory, invoice of what that was bought. You know what I mean?
So you go to a shop where
a tobacco store.
You go to the Joyandian or Yanjodian, whatever. Then they might be able to. But anyways, it's the idea of the ability to reach and advertise to these groups of people. Plus, and that's the access, and then the potential is in the data. I guess the potential is in the recommendation, the analysis, the, you know, how they can increase the efficiency between the vendor and the banker and the.
I think it's just they have a lot of users. Their users open their app a certain number of times a day, or week, or month, or whatever. As long as they keep those numbers, engagement high, user numbers high, they're going to have demand aggregation to some degree of financial services. And as long as they can kind of keep being a source of financial, you know, needs for consumers, the financial partners will come to them. And then I think their next step is probably something around the lines of like building an OS for financial services, kind of like how Meituan's trying to, you know, build the OS for restaurants and local services and stuff like that. So I think that's kind of like the big pie in the sky goal. I mean, they used to call this fintech platform, they used to call it Ant Financial Cloud, which was like literally to build the base, the cloud infrastructure of financial services, which was, you know, maybe that's still what they're trying to do. Now, obviously, it's hard to do that because I think most companies know once they sign on to something like that, they can't, you know.
But if you
trapped,
yeah,
you know, businesses.
But at the same time, how it seems very difficult to go around it. You know, this when I just, you know, dealing with my friends in China, you know, one thing I've noticed, you know, Alipay has always been popular, but more and more, I think over the last few years, I've seen this kind of evolution to a super app where people don't want to keep a lot of their money on WhatsApp that they want to be using, you know, their Alipay or their Zhifu Bao, right? That app more and more often, and they're wanting to use it more and more because they trust it, because that's kind of the more, you know, financially, I don't know, like that.
Dude, also the bank apps suck.
Yeah, right. So it's not the inconvenient bank app. It's not the inconvenient bank app, but it's also not the chat app that became a bank app. It's the digital finance app, and it has that sort of allure. What are the chances and how? So it there's so much potential here, right? So we see all the businesses going through it, but then we also see that there are so many areas for growth, right? Whether or not they want to essentially create that SaaS service for and be the go-to portal for the entire financial services industry.
I'm sure they want to, but I'm sure there's a lot of resistance.
Yeah, or whether or not they can, right? So, they're in some ways, I think that their biggest obstacle here is regulation, right? It's that a lot of these kind of natural directions that they would go into would be monopolistic, that they could take over the financial services, but the regulators probably won't.
Well, I mean, the banks already have a sour, you know, taste in their mouth from Yuabao and kind of losing a lot of business to these guys. So yeah. I doubt they're going to, the banks won't do it.
So but what are those threats though? What are the chances that they, like, what, if you are bearish on Ant Financial, which I'm not, I don't think you are, what are the threats to their business and their future growth?
There's a lot. I mean, I have like a list of, and we can do it now or we could do it at the end, but kind of the big picture stepping back and looking at the landscape for Ant. So I think, you know, number one, they have new lending caps, interest rate caps, which should, you know, stop some of that credit tech sort of piece, because they make money based on a percentage of the interest charged of the balance. So that'll lower their revenues there. I think they currently can go all the way up to like probably close to 30% annualized. And now the new caps, I think, are like, and this is another thing, you know, might get our numbers wrong, I'm literally pulling this out of this void in my head, 15.7%, I think, is the new cap. So that might be higher or lower, whatever.
Waiting for that lawsuit on the 15.9, actually? No.
Do not sue us. We are not responsible for any losses. Okay. Then the other big questions are stuff we've talked about on the podcast before, you know, DCEP, you know, how will DCEP impact Alipay and WeChat? This is that big chunk, their transaction, you know, revenue, digital payments revenue. Will commercial banks assert themselves in further into these transactions? There's also the question of can transaction service revenue even rise? We've seen it going down since 2017. Mm-hmm. You know, is the take rate going to stay low? Or are they going to use that as like kind of the open door to get everybody on their platform and staying there? Or will again, DCEP completely change this? And then also, you know, what I was just talking about, the financial service partners, whether they would let them into their ecosystems or let them build their ecosystems, you know, can they actually become a de facto OS for financial services? And, you know, or will these partners seek to build their own systems as they have and kind of keep the ants at bay?
Yeah. Yeah. Keep the ants out of the kitchen.
That's how you get ants.
Because that I think is my biggest question, is that they have so many leads in so many areas that if they were able to grow kind of more organically, or grow without these sort of kind of built-in obstacles, largely by the state, whether it be the Chinese state or elsewhere, that they would be just a sure shot to be maybe China's first trillion-dollar company, potentially.
I think I don't know what's going on, but it seems like a lot of news is I kind of thought, I mean, I tweeted about this, but I kind of thought that like Chinese regulators would wait until after this massive blockbuster IPO to start changing regulations and making like a little business a little harder for Ant. And they don't seem to be doing that. So I think there's definitely like there's the trend. The landscape is changing in such a way that it looks like it's getting harder for them. Now, does that mean it's going to be the end of the end of Ant? No way. I mean, they're not going away because they're tied to Alibaba. They have
an institution.
Tons of users. They have a much better UI. I mean, people like using it. They don't like using the bank apps, most of them. So they're still going to win on the consumer side. It's just going to get it's going to be tough on the other side.
Yeah. When I look at it, there's DSEP and the kind of competition from banks. And if you consider that the 4 to 5 big kind of Chinese state banks are the children of the PBOC, and they're the ones who are kind of issuing the DSEP. I mean, that's a formidable opponent, if not that they can put out a better product, that they can just put up a lot of obstacles to Ant Financial's growth. The other area there, the other side of the coin there is, you know, they attempted to acquire MoneyGram in, I think, 2017, 2018. And the U.S. CFIUS blocked that acquisition because
That would have been a great acquisition for, I mean, like they had their eyes on the right idea. I mean, that would have been a great, because they have, and we can kind of jump to it, but they have like, you know, a use of proceeds section in there. It's like a page and a half. It's sort of like basically a page of like what they're going to do with all this money they raise in the IPO, right? And part of it is this cross-border payment and merchant services expansion. The other two main things are enhance innovation and R&D. And number one, which I think is probably going to be the largest chunk, is further pursue our vision to digitize the service industry. So kind of trying to bring in more partners, get deeper into their, you know, systems, right? So build that little OS, but very incrementally, gradually, keep their user base growing and engaged, and then increase their breadth and depth of cooperation with those partners. So,
but they're like, they have so many avenues. I mean, there's so much natural growth for them that it's like if you squeeze, I don't know the best analogy here, but it's like if you squeeze one of those like koosh balls, right? And then you'll still have like some of it that like comes out through your fingers, or like some Play-Doh or something like that, right? That there's just too much of it that it's just going to get out anyway.
Like the mass of the thing will not be reduced.
Exactly. Yeah, like there's just too much there. But it's something like they're the tiger in the cage in the zoo, where if you let everybody out of the cage, like the tiger eats everybody else. But my question is the cages. Like there are too many cages right now that it's going to hinder their growth quite a bit. The question is how much.
Well, it's kind of funny because like they got big and they kind of got into all this stuff because there really weren't that many cages in the past. And, you know, I think PBOC took, you know, under Zhou Xiaochuan, took a view of like allowing digital finance to kind of flourish a little bit and see what happens, right? He took like a kind of market kind of base sort of organic, you know, growth sort of view, which is awesome. And it created a ton of value and a ton of economic value added for all these players and partners and, you know, all this consumers and everything. So, I mean, it's been good, but it also created a lot of cost, which was mainly in the peer-to-peer lending stuff where people lost a ton of money and there was a lot of fraud and, you know, problems. Alipay was somewhat involved in that. They had their own peer-to-peer platform. I'm pretty sure they made their lenders, you know, the consumer lenders whole on their platform because they could, but not everybody was, you know, huge in doing this. So the next kind of thing, I mean, we went through the revenue. You know, if you look at their operating profit, you know, it looks really nice. It's 20%, but they had this kind of big drop in 2018. And so I went and looked at kind of like what caused that. And the cause of it was they increased their promotion and advertising expenses like almost 3x. because they wanted to increase their MAUs on an Alipay app. And they did that. They got for 3X, you know, promotion and advertising, they got about a quarter more users, which is pretty big jump. So, you know, then they kind of ramped it back down to normal levels. And now it's like, it seems to be even below what it was before 2018. So on an annualized run rate. So maybe they, you know, they bit the bullet early and did that. So then I also just want to kind of run through the cost structure here. Like, so their transaction fees, you know, are a big chunk of their cost of services. And, you know, you can see their total cost of services as a percent of revenue in the first half of this year was about 41%. But it before it was running, you know, 2019 full year, it was like 50%. Before that, it was 2018, 48, 36 before that. So these transaction service fees are kind of jumping up and causing their gross margins to go down a little bit. And let's see, G&A expenses are pretty normal. The only thing that stood out in here was royalty and service payment. And this is related to, we can't have a podcast and not mention what happened with Jack Ma moving Alipay out of Alibaba back in 2011 due to quote unquote fears that the government wouldn't give them a license. But now that Alibaba has their 33% stake, which was based on the 2014, so he moved it out. This is what happened. He moved it out. And then in 2014, I guess everyone learned that that had happened. And then they had this new agreement, which is this royalty and service payment agreement that basically said that they would pay Alibaba until Alibaba executed their equity purchase, quote unquote purchase, because it's not really a purchase. It's like an exchange of intangible assets for a 33% stake of Ant Group. All this kind of is really funny because Alibaba has been a VIE the whole time, and it isn't in China's eyes in legal sense in just about every way, is not considered a foreign company. So this whole, you know, fear that government wouldn't give them some licenses or whatever because they were a foreign company is kind of all bogus to me.
From what I understand, Yahoo's involvement with some of that.
Yeah, they had no idea.
Yeah.
Yahoo and SoftBank had no idea that this was transferred out from underneath them, which, you know, it's pretty clear this is a valuable business.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously. And then Jack Ma, basically, he's still the controlling shareholder of it. You know, he's, you know, kind of stepping away, I guess, from Alibaba. And, you know, this is his thing now. So
everything around Ant has always been very foggy to me. Like, there's this whole idea of like how much, in what ways are they associated with Alibaba and in what ways are they not? Like, there's the Jack Ma involvement, but it's something that is, you know, they go hand in hand with Alibaba, but they're not the same company.
Oh, yeah. No, there's a whole pages and pages in the listing document about all that, the connections and the, you know, related parties. I mean, connected transactions, all that. I did not look at that. But I know it's deep. There's a lot of stuff. It's all legal talk and, you know, it's fine. And they're not going to separate, you know. I don't think so. But the question is, I mean, the thing in China you always kind of got to look out for is how are the kind of heads of the company looking under the graces of the, you know, current government administration kind of thing. And you know, you kind of just hope that Jack Ma's still doing good.
Although, I mean, they're at a situation where they're, I mean, as long as for the last 5 to 10 years, they've been so big that it's something where it's hard to see, you know, the payment system in China and the economy of China really functioning without them. But, you know, I mean, we've seen this before. You know, it's not the only company to.
Well, DCEP is supposed to be, I mean, my friends who are like big into DCEP and thinks it's really going to change a lot of things. So
it seems like there are these big, you know, there are these big threats. I mean, it's this company that is this titan, that is this mammoth. You know, it's the tiger in the zoo that if you take down the cages, they probably eat everybody up. But yeah, it's how exactly does it play out? I don't there are so many obstacles, and almost all of them are regulatory, whether it be, you know, in China, or whether it be, you know, how they want to move their business abroad, and some of those obstacles as well. But it's
yeah, I think, I mean, there's also some competition obstacles, but they're not nearly as impactful to, you know, the revenue streams of the business as I think regulatory would be. But there are, you know, I mean, look, stepping back, payments business, if they can keep it and it keeps going, is an amazing business. I mean, it grows.
But just all the data that flows with that, all the data that goes along with that, and all the insights that they can provide from that.
I mean, the data is somewhat helpful, but the real awesome thing is, it's like, if you can keep a high percentage of transactions, you know, in your country, and it's a percentage of the transaction volume, which means if there's inflation, you're automatically getting an increase in your revenue. You're automatically being compensated. If your country grows GDP-wise, you know, if your economy grows,
tagged to GDP,
you get more digital payments going on, right? If more people rise in disposable income, you get more digital payments, which means those two things times each other, you're going to be growing faster than GDP in this segment of your business forever, you know, as long as that goes on.
and not just that, it's every growth sector too. Right? So you could talk about the economy growing, but in addition to that,
payments is between everything. Nothing gets done without a payment. If something has to get paid, things have to, you know.
Every growth industry is tied to something like Ant Financial, right? So e-commerce, obviously, is growing at a rate that outpaces the rest of the economy. That's tied to Ant Financial. All online to offline business, everything in major cities. You know, however, all the growth industries in China, it's all digital. So, and how do you pay for things digitally? Well, over 50%, I think 60%, are paid by Alipay. So, well, at least now, we'll see.
If they can keep it, it's amazing. So anyway, going back through their expenses, this is probably the most boring part of this, but their R&D expenses look very normal, you know, salary and welfare benefits and stock-based compensation. Other income and gains net, this is kind of, there was a big number in 2018. Again, 2018 seems to be the year they did a bunch of stuff. This was when Kobe, which was, I guess, part of Alipay back then, was restructured away from Alipay and into quote unquote local services with Ulema underneath Alibaba. So they took like a little bit of a hit there on income, other income. Actually, I think they put it as like a gain. So they had to take it out of their cash flows because there was no real cash being transferred there. Then, that's kind of it on the expenses. And that brings you down to basically, you know, income tax is pretty normal. They have finance income is normal. You know, they had a bunch of share of profits and losses for associates and JVs. You know, these are usually less than 5% of revenue. So they get down to profit for the year. And these are good numbers. You know, profit margin, this is IFRS, is, you know, 2017 was 12.5%. Then because 2018 was that weird year with the really high sales and marketing expenses, dropped down to 2.5%. Then 2019, 15%. So an improvement on 2017. And then for some reason, the first half of 2019 was not good, 3.6%. But then this year, first half of 2020, is all the way up to 30.2%, which is, you know, the COVID 19 e-commerce growth. I mean, a lot more digital payments, probably. I mean, there's a lot of things driving that, but I don't know if that's necessarily sustainable. We'll have to. Yeah, I wouldn't. If I was making a model and going out, I would not be estimating, 30% profit margins in the future for this. But, you know, they in a way, like in the beginning we said, are they kind of like Visa or MasterCard? I mean, Visa, MasterCard have over 50% net profit margins, and they, you know, they don't do a lot of things. They just, they kind of just, they run and they do a bunch of other things, but the main thing is that network, the card network. And, you know, just looking at, I mean, Visa network spend in RMB was like 79 trillion. Total payment volume on Ant Group was 117.9 trillion. So quite a bit higher. I think it's also, if you add MasterCard to that, I think Ant Group is ahead. But the weird thing is COVID for Ant Group was probably a booster, whereas COVID for Visa and MasterCard was not, right? It's the, it's kind of, so.
Why?
Well, if you just look.
Just because of the amount. If
you, just the amount of people, buying and travel, you know, international. I mean, they have like, so they're not like really comparable at this point in time. But, you know, I think the way people shop in kind of the countries where Visa and MasterCard have their network, which by the way, Visa's total cards is like 3.4 billion cards out there. That's really? Debit and credit. Yeah, it's huge, dude. MasterCard, I think, is somewhere close to that. And so it's, I mean, these are massive. So I think where they have their cards, the economy, the lockdowns, the people not going out, even if there are no lockdowns, people still didn't go out and buy as much stuff. You see just about everything is down except groceries. You know, I mean, healthcare is still not recovered, elective healthcare especially. You see, I mean, all these segments, and actually, if anyone's interested, Visa and MasterCard do release, you know, kind of numbers of their network spend pretty frequently. And it's been very interesting to see kind of the, as it slowly gets back, I think it's just getting back to normal now. So anyway, I think, you know, people made a big mess about how they're bigger than Visa and MasterCard, and Alipay, Ali Group is bigger than Visa and MasterCard. But I think it's, this COVID thing had a, had quite a helping hand there. So anyway,
but they're also just so much, they seem to be so much more vertically integrated. Like that they'll get their finger in so many more of the financial services pies that, you know, that Visa and MasterCard just seem to do the horizontal thing so much more.
Well, I mean, maybe the Visa and MasterCard have a pretty crazy history. They were in more things, and they kind of, it's, we don't, I don't want to go through it. But they, the network that they run is really the key thing, and that's really a profitable, awesome thing. And I mean, if you're making over 50% net margins, I don't think you need to go into, you know, and like regulation wise, they're probably more protected, right? So yeah, I think you're, you know, if they were in China, it'd probably be different, where there probably would be some groups, you know, wanting to kind of cut back on their profit margins or get some, a piece of it. Whereas like out in the, you know, kind of non-China world, it's, they've sort of just established themselves in a pretty good position. But you know, that could also change with, you know, Bitcoin and Libra, and probably not Libra anymore, but like some things can, technology can still disrupt them for sure. So
we're coming up on an hour here.
All right.
But let's, to wrap things up, give me a reason why not to buy them. And then give me a reason to buy them, I guess. But we've talked about many reasons to buy them.
I mean, so I'm not going to, you know,
Not investment advice.
Not recommendations. But if I was going to make this decision, which I am going to do this analysis, and I haven't done it yet, but I'm going to do it. So it's like, I would look at, you know, on a worst case, you know, I like to look at scenarios, right? So on, I look at what's the worst case. The worst case to me is this digital payment piece gets like wiped out or wiped in half or something. Like something happens and they're only left with the digital fintech platform, and that would be pretty bad for them. So you're talking about losing a third of their revenue if the first half of this year's kind of numbers are indicative of the future. you know, it's not the end of the world. They'd still probably be okay. I mean, and their transaction fees would probably go down. So there would be probably an increase in gross margin. So, I mean, like, but things would look quite a bit different, and you'd want to kind of figure out how that looks, you know, a few years down the road, while also looking at, you know, China's growth, you know, growth in consumer, growth in disposable income, GDP growth. All these things are kind of revenue drivers, I think, for them. And, you know, I think in terms of credit tech and investment tech, these two, I think I'm actually more bullish on than insurtech, because I don't know how big insurance is going to be. I mean, America's kind of like very insured, you know, like overinsured, I'd even go to say. So I don't think China's going to get to that level. I think there's also, you know, the way insurance products are kind of done in China or not, they're just a little different.
But however they happen, they'll happen through Ant, probably. Or Ant will be able to offer a more, like a better priced product.
Yeah, yeah. So that, I'm not arguing. I mean, so what I'm looking at is the TAM for that piece of the business. And I don't think it's going to grow as fast as probably I've been reading other people think it's going to grow. I think credit tech is more interesting. That's a space that, number one, aligns with like the government's things they want, right? They've been constantly wanting to get loans to these small, medium-sized businesses, private businesses, and it just hasn't really worked. And the banks just can't do it because they have. And I worked in finance in China for a while, and I've met with bankers and tried to get loans and gotten loans for companies. So what you see is, like, you know, they do all this, they do some credit analysis, they do it, they really go through the rungs and everything. But then at the end of the day, it comes down to just one question. And that's, do you have any collateral? Do you have anything you can like DIA, yihang, right? So if you don't have any collateral because you're a small business, you have a restaurant with pretty high working capital needs compared to, you know, your revenues and everything, but you don't have any assets. So you don't have anything to give as collateral, really. You have like your ability to make the stuff you have, you know, which is intangible. You have your recipes, which is intangible. If you don't own the restaurant like location, which most of these guys don't, you're paying rent. I mean, so you don't have anything. So the only thing,
but you can determine that value much better through some sort of digital aggregation.
So the only thing you have collateral you have is future revenue, right? Which is at the end of the day a lot more wishy-washy, because you could just close up shop in peace, and then that loan.
But you can, if you're Ant, you can, and you have all that data. Like, there, it's far more easy for you to develop some sort of credit mechanism or credit algorithm for those folks.
Which is why this is such a, that's the area I'm kind of bullish on. And that's the area that the government wants. And if they can give it, you know, I mean, Ant should be making arguments constantly like, look, we need digital payments. We need this because it helps us with this credit tech thing. And, you know, we're creating a lot of value here for the entire economy. And that leads to stability, because people that need loans and are suffering or have a working capital gap, or something happens, they need lower interest, you know, loans that are not from loan sharks or, you know, from trust products to charge, you know, much higher return, and still want all of your collateral. Like, I mean, if you own a restaurant and you own an apartment, your apartment is 100% going to be mortgaged to that loan for the restaurant. So if you lose your restaurant, you lose your home too. I mean, it's like crazy. But anyway, that's a bigger piece. Investment tech, I think, is a big piece too, because just wealth of, I think, the Chinese population is going to be increasing.
And they don't want to, like, such a big issue is in China, in our time there, is what is a reliable place to put your income? You know, that's why real estate's so big there. That's why, you know, you'll have people.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's so much else. It's so much. It's so hard to, there's a trust deficit, I think, in so many of these areas, that if you can provide that trust formula, right, then that's a huge opportunity.
Yeah, but trust, so the problem with saying that trust here in this case, because Alipay is not the end product thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is going to be confusing to consumers, because if they buy an investment product through Alipay,
they're not liable.
And then that investment product fails, because guess what? There is risk. When you want higher return, there is risk on these things. It's the same thing when you go to like your China Construction Bank and you buy a trust product from XX, you know, trust company that's not China Construction Bank. People think, oh, because I bought it here and this is a state-owned bank, I mean, the bank will make me whole. There's no risk here. And they literally think that. And sometimes the salespeople tell them that. They're not supposed to.
Yeah.
But like, that's why when you go buy one of these products, you're actually supposed to write out in like your own writing. And sometimes they even have you repeat, like read a document and they film you reading it, which says, I know this is risk. I could lose all my money, you know, all this stuff. But people still think, even with all that, they still think that they're going to be made whole and they don't like losing money. So, I mean, there is like that's sort of the risk piece, is if there is some sort of major economic, you know, turbulent time, people are going to lose money in their investment tech platform. I mean, it's just going to happen. And do they blame Alipay for that, or do they blame look through Alipay? How good is the look through? I mean, all this stuff is
It would be easy for the big banks to also point the finger. That's also.
Oh, when things, you know, fail.
They say, oh, it's not us. It's Alipay. They're the ones who screwed up.
Dude, exactly. When things fail, everyone's going to be like, oh, wait, I'm not responding. Yeah. You're the one who sold the product. And then, no, you're the one who backed the product. Oh, you're the guarantor to the product. And you're the guarantor to the guarantor. Oh, the guarantor to the guarantor is missing. He's just gone. Like, okay, then what happened? You know, I mean, this is the mess that happens back there. So anyway,
but if you're, it's one of those things, and I said this always with Alibaba, is that if you're, we can have all the criticisms about Alibaba, but you know, if you're genuinely or generally, you know, bullish on the China economy, you probably want to buy and hold Alibaba. And I feel like there's a similar sense with this company. That's my take on it.
Yeah, no, I think to me, you know, doing all that stuff, looking at the TAM of each one and doing that kind of worst case scenario, I just kind of want to see what's a price range that would be interesting to buy this company at, given those potential risks in the future.
And then considering the prices that we've seen over the past few months, you know, the valuations are out of control. So,
yeah, it's very likely this thing's going to pop on its IPO. It's already oversubscribed. I mean, this thing is like, it's going to be a beast, you know, so. Anyways. But maybe there'll be some bad news in the next 6 months and it'll knock it down a notch or two. And then if that price range is where I kind of did my analysis and I'm prepared for it, then that's like, you know, that's the time to be involved for me, at least. That's the way I kind of think about things. Okay. Should we wrap it up? We're at an hour 10. Oh, geez.
Anyway, anything else we get? Yeah. Anything else? You see, we can't. We're unable to have a short podcast. It is not possible. It is not within our capabilities. Anyways, techno.com/newsletters for your daily dose of China tech. Follow James on Twitter at James Hull X, JamesHullX. I'm Elliot Zagman, ELLIOTTZAAGMAN. James, anything else we want to say?
And if you found this of any value, please, please write a review. Apple Podcasts or a star or whatever, or tweet about it, share it. You know, that's kind of how to pay us back here. you know, we are doing this, you know, I wouldn't say super in-depth analysis, but it's some analysis for you for free. So if you appreciate it, yeah, give us a shout out on social media or write a review. We appreciate all that. Yeah.
Those jokes that I have at the beginning of every podcast, I give you those for free. And James, and I surprise James with them for free. Every single time I'm like, how am I gonna catch James off guard with this?
Yeah, you always get me somehow. It's pretty good. Well, let's finish with, sure. I'll just say, you know, old friend of mine used to say this all the time. He said, look, you get what you pay for. So free advice is what you pay for, right? Anyway. Hopefully this is more valuable than that to people. So yeah, please, reply or send us something on WeChat or, not on WeChat. Never mind. Twitter and a review. We appreciate that.
Twitter is,
emails work. Yeah.
Or email.
ChinaTechInvestor@outlook.com. If you want to do that.
Yeah. They're not blocking emails. Anyways, so you can join us all again next time on the China Tech Investor Podcast. Bye-bye now.